everybody, and welcome to another episode of Kaiju Carnage. I am your host, Kyle the Kaiju Guy. So, what's up, everybody? Finally, I'm here for what is quite possibly the most anticipated episode that I've been looking at doing since I started this podcast 2.5 years ago, and I'm joined by my good friend from over at Kid Kong at the Movies. You will hear me refer to him as Kid Kong, and Chris, both. So, you know, because I can't break that habit. So, thank you for being here, Chris.
Oh, no problem. If you guys can't tell, Cal's a bit excited.
I'm very excited.
This is what we've talked about for years now.
I started my podcast in December of 2020. And I remember Jaws was going to be the very first movie that I was texting you about saying, I don't know if I should cover this or not because It's not a kaiju film. And I was like, but it's a very iconic film. And I was like, maybe we'll do it. And so this is my birthday movie. And I'm going to explain that here in a minute as to why this is legitimately my birthday movie. And I was like, well, you know, for the 4th of July, as well as my birthday, I think we'll do Jaws. But then something happened. I can't remember what it was. We ended up not being able to do it. And I was like, I don't want to do it in August. I don't want to do it in August or something like that. Like, it's a 4th of July thing. I want to do it around that time. So the next year rolls around, and he and I are heavily talking about doing it and doing a third segment. But due to things that have occurred, that fell apart. And so I was like, dadgummit. And so I remember texting you. It was like August of last year.
It was, yeah.
I was like, we're doing Jaws in 2023. That's just all it is to it. We're going to do it. We need to tell ourselves we're going to do it and all that stuff. And so, yeah, we came up with the concept of part one and part two. I know I've told you guys probably every episode for about the last month and a half about what was going to happen. Part one is going to be on my show right here, Kaiju Carnage. Part two is going to be on his show, Kid Kong at the Movies. I'm going to cover a little bit about Peter Benchley, the conception, original conception of the novel, the different things that went into writing the novel and different inspirations for Peter Benchley, studios discovering it, getting interested in it, it being shopped around to different places, the numerous directors that were attached to this movie before we got Mr. Spielberg, and as well as the casting. And then as soon as I get done with the casting, that's going to be the end of part one. And then Chris is going to handle all the production, impact, legacy. Like, we're going to talk about the franchise overall, like its sequels and all that kind of stuff. There's a PlayStation 2 video game and all of that. We're going to talk about that. And that's going to be on his show and all that. So, yeah, I mean, we know what we're doing. It's a crossover thing.
It's also important to note that this episode almost, once again, did not get to happen this year. You see, we initially had planned on recording this. Cal is fixing to be going to Colorado with his wife.
Yes.
And we were going to record before he did that. However, earlier this year, my ex and her husband got career opportunities and moved back to her home state, which is in Michigan. We're down here in Louisiana. My daughter went with them because I'd have to be an idiot to want my child to willingly be educated down here if that can be avoided. So I allowed that to go to happen. Again, her mother and I have a great relationship.
For those of you that don't understand that reference about children being raised in Louisiana, Louisiana has routinely, in about the last 15 years, swapped places with Mississippi as the least educated, or in layman's terms, dumbest state in the nation. And so, yeah, our education system down here, I could tell you guys horror stories left and right about what my experience in high school was. Like, just to give y'all a little bit of a taste, I had one teacher that if he didn't feel like teaching us anything that day, he passed out word searches. And he would literally say, if you even just attempt to do it, you don't even have to finish it. If you attempt to do it, I will give you an A. That is one teacher in one year that I had. And my school year was chock full of teachers pretty much just like that. So that's why he would not want his daughter to willingly be educated here as opposed to one with a higher education system.
Exactly. And fortunately, again, her mother and I have a fantastic relationship. Now we really, truly do. So it was just a better idea that I was like, yeah, you know, go ahead and do this. We'll figure everything out. So that first week of July, myself and my wife are driving up to Michigan to spend the 4th of July with her up there. And then when we drive back down, she's coming back down with us. This obviously created an issue with potentially trying to record this episode, because whether it was him being gone or me being gone, the time that we initially had slated for this wasn't going to happen. So we were like, we're just going to have to do it. And we were concerned initially that, okay, we don't want to record this if he's got other episodes that have to drop before then. But if you set, when you schedule when the episodes are going to drop, you can schedule one for tomorrow. Record one today, release it today, and the one for tomorrow will still drop tomorrow at the scheduled time. So there's not really an issue with that. So once we got that figured out, I got my notes set up for my half. He got his notes set up for his half. And today we actually just got done rewatching the movie. So not that it needs to be fresher in our minds, but it is fresher in our minds as we discuss it.
He and I were quoting this movie all throughout the film, and there was one part where we just busted out laughing. It's at the end not at the very end, probably about 20 minutes left in the film. And when they're singing Show Me the Way to Go Home, and when it got to the part where they all start singing and all of that, even down to the drumming that they were doing on the table, me and him both did it in unison with the characters and all that, and we just started laughing, and I said, we have seen this film way too many times.
A fair few, yes, sir.
And the reason that I picked you to be on this with me is, well, let's be honest here, I could have helmed this by myself.
No, absolutely.
I 100% could have.
Just as I could have done an episode on Jaws by myself.
But I'm that type of Jaws fan. I'm just going to give you guys, I know I'm kind of going on a little bit before I get to the episode.
We'll get to it. You guys know what it is at this point.
I own, it's actually sitting right next to me, and I've got it because there's a little booklet that comes with it, and if I decided that I wanted to look through there and see if there's any kind of little fun facts or something like that, I would be able to have that at the ready. But I have the Ultra HD Blu-ray 4K edition to Jaws. It's a collector's edition sitting right next to me. I have a first print that came out in 1974 of the original Jaws novel. I'm currently wearing a Jaws TV t-shirt in which there's not even a camera on us. But I'm like, oh no, I'm wearing a shirt for this.
Oh, yeah.
And so we watched the movie. I actually have three Jaws shirts, but the other two I use strictly for sleeping because of like the material that they're made out of, like that.
Yeah, they're softer.
That polyester type material and all that. And so, yeah, I've got three Jaws shirts altogether. I have a few collectibles of Jaws. Lego just announced about a week ago that they're going to be doing a Lego set of the Orca, as well as Bruce. Bruce is the name of the shark. One of us will tell you guys why, if you're not aware of it, later on. And because there is a reason why it's named Bruce. And the shark from Finding Nemo is actually named after the
great
shark.
Great white, no less.
Yeah, from Jaws. That's why.
Voiced by Barry Humphries, who only recently passed away.
Yeah, that is why in Finding Nemo, there is a great white shark by the name of Bruce. It was an homage to Jaws. But anywho, yeah. You can build the Orca, Bruce. It comes in with a Quint, a Hooper, and a Brody. It's going to be the first Lego set I've probably purchased in a good 25 years.
Yeah, he posted it on Facebook and tagged me. I was like, Chris, we're building this when it's available.
Yeah.
There's no debate about that.
Either I'm buying it and we're going to build it together, or I'm buying one and you're buying one and we'll build our set simultaneously.
Yeah.
One or the other, but I'm going to have that Lego Orca and Bruce and the trio of guys and all of that. And I was telling Chris earlier that at Walmart, they actually have a figure that's about $35 of Hooper whenever at the end of the film, whenever he's in his scuba gear and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Jaws. I was first introduced to Jaws whenever I was about 5 years old. Big surprise here, it wasn't in a hotel room for a change. How I was introduced to this was my granny, the one that's Choctaw that I've talked to you guys about before. She would record movies that came on like NBC and stuff like that. And a lot of times, you know, and that's how I got to see a lot of, like, rated R movies and stuff whenever I was younger, because NBC shows, like, highly edited versions of the movies and all of that. Well, one of the movies that came on one day was Jaws, and she knew that I'm into, I had already discovered Moby Dick, and so she knew that I was into, like, sea creatures and all that stuff, and so she's like, well, maybe Michael will like this and everything. For those of you that don't know, my real name is Michael. Don't know if I've ever specified that or not. So,
but y'all, there are people that have known this man for years that still don't know that. So, like,
yeah,
straight up, like, Cal is very much taking on a full port of his nickname.
So. I really have. There's some people that whenever I say something about Michael, they're like, "Who's Michael?" And I'm like, "Me, I'm Michael." What? Like, oh, so is Cal your middle name? I'm like, no, it's literally just a nickname. But because I'm a Superman fan, you guys know that. But anywho, so she brings me the tape, and I watch it. I fell in love with it, and it's one of those movies that I wore that tape out as a child. Like, by the time, you know, the era of, by the time I was a teenager and able to buy DVDs and stuff like that, or just watch it whenever it came on, the tape was no longer watchable. Like, you could plug it in and it would play, but good luck seeing what was happening on the screen. And so I think that's part of the reason as to why I have the film almost memorized the way that I do, is because a lot of times, because that was my only option to watch, because I watched it so many times and the screen would be so fuzzy, all I could hear was the audio. And so, like, yeah. I would just listen to the audio over and over and over again. And so then eventually I did buy it on DVD. I did have the PlayStation 2 Jaws game. I have not played. Don't ask me anything about it.
Dude, because I have, never got I have the not, chance to play it.
I have not played it since its release.
Like, I never got the chance, like, to play it. For those of y'all old enough to remember this, Game Informer used to have magazines about video games that would come out every single year.
They still do.
Does Game Informer still go? I did not know that. I, up until only a few years ago, had an issue with Game Informer that I got when I was 13, which would have been when the Jaws game came out, that had a feature on that talking about how there was a bonus mission where you, as the shark, would get to fight a killer whale at one point. Like, I discovered the movie. I was probably around the same age you were, maybe just a little bit older than you were at the time. And it was just one of those things, they were showing it on TV. And I liked it, and my grandfather found a VHS tape of it and got me a VHS tape of it. That VHS tape, moving around when we were younger, we really didn't have a whole lot of really anything. We had a few movies, and my grandparents would buy me and my brother Game Boys. That was about it. One of the movies that I did have was Jaws, and I watched it a lot. Like, I can remember being a kid the first time I put it on there and being confused, because when the movie started, it wasn't actually the movie. The VHS tape my grandfather had got me had a 45-minute long, like, miniature making-of documentary about the movie. So, like, I've known details about this movie long before I knew details about almost any other movie I'd ever seen.
Yeah, by the way, just in case anyone was wondering, it is the name of the game was called Jaws Unleashed, and it came out in 2006. That's the year that I graduated high school.
Was it in 2006?
It came out May 23rd, 2006. So I can't remember my exact graduation date, then. But it was right at the time that I graduated high school and all that stuff. And yeah, I loved the game like there's no tomorrow, but we all know that there are times that we have very fond memories playing games whenever we were teenagers and all that. And then if you try to revisit that game as an adult, you're like, how did I ever possibly enjoy this? So I don't know about that with Jaws, because I have not played it since 2007, 2008, something like that. But
I'm going to go ahead and guess it'd probably be similar to, you know, Echo the Dolphin, in that when you're a kid, you enjoy playing it, even though it's got some difficult levels. Playing it as an adult, you're probably like, yeah, this is stupid.
Yeah, probably. Who knows? But anywho, so yeah, that's how big of a Jaws fan that I am. It got to the point to where whenever I would go over to my father's house and, you know, I would just start watching TV. If Jaws came on, because he had DirecTV, if Jaws came on, I didn't care at what point in the movie it was on. I did not care. I didn't care if it had just started, if it was in the middle, if I didn't care if they was just fixing to blow up the shark. I would click on it and finish watching it. And my dad would get to the point to where he's like, you watched that yesterday. or you watched that the day before and everything. And I'm like, who cares? I'm very comfortable in saying I have very likely seen this movie more than I've seen any other movie I've ever watched.
This movie's right up there with that for me. It's possible that maybe Ninja Turtles or Tremors is above it, but it's such a narrow margin that it's difficult to say.
The only movie that would come close to it for me is the Conan the Barbarian film that came out in the 80s with Arnold.
Yeah.
Because, you know, or possibly Return of the Jedi. But if I was a gambling man, I think I would have to put it on Jaws. But anywho, so before I jump into the book, I've told you guys before that I went through a little spurt there in my mid-20s or something like that, where I would see either a movie that was based on a book or a movie that said based on a true story. And I'm like, well, let's see. And so I would go and find the book so that I could read it and basically see, like, what's the deal with it, what's going on with it, and all of that kind of stuff. And I did this with a number of books. That's how I found out that the story of Balto is a lie. Anyone who wants to know the true story, go and watch the movie Togo that is on Disney
Plus. With Willem Dafoe?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic movie. That's how I found out that was a lie. That's how I found out that Disney's film Hidalgo is predominantly a lie. The guy
Fox
that
the Hound the, also.
Yeah, Fox and the Hound.
Don't ever read that book.
Don't ever read that book.
I read the synopsis of that book and I wish I never did it.
Fox and the Hound, I will tell anybody, is the only book I've ever read in my life that I regret reading and that I could honestly go back to a time where I had not read the book. It is extremely sad. It is very, very messed up. And yeah, if you're even the slightest bit of either a fan of the animated film or an animal lover, avoid that book like the plague. It will make you cry.
It makes the ending of Where the Red Fern Grows seem like a Sunday morning cartoon.
Oh, Where the Red Fern Grows is nothing compared to this,
it's
the Hound.
It's ridiculous.
God. I was just telling Emily about it probably a month ago when she was crying with me just giving her little plot points.
That's why I won't tell Kira that, because that exact same reason.
Like,
it's like, no, I know you. I ain't telling you nothing.
No, it's a terrible book. But, so I'm sitting there, you know, I read The Snowman. They was getting ready to make a movie of that, and so I read the book. I did not know the book was book 7 in a series, so that was the first 100 pages of that book was extremely confusing to me. But, so I got through that. And then at one point, I was like, you know what? I'm going to read Jaws. As much as I love the movie, I'm going to read Jaws. I've never really heard anything about the book or anything like that, so let's check it out. And so, yeah, I started reading the book, and I was about 6 or 7 chapters in, and I was like, this is nothing like the movie. The characters are nothing like their movie counterparts. About the only things in common between the book and the movie is there's a man-eating shark. They go to hunt it down. Mm-hmm. And that's basically where the similarities end. And I'm not talking about like similarities of like, well, the book is always different from the movie.
No, this is quite a bit different.
Like, it's extremely different. Like, I'll get to this. One of us will get to it later on, but whenever Spielberg read the book, he essentially was like, he's like, these people are terrible.
Yeah.
These characters are terrible. There's no way.
Unlikable and irredeemable.
Unlikable, irredeemable. He said, you find yourself rooting for the shark with how terrible these people were.
Which, in today's day and age of movies, that's okay. You know, Cocaine Bear, I was rooting for that damn bear.
Well, I think
the whole time.
I think all of us were, to be honest.
Back then in the 70s, you're not really going to be rooting for... You're not supposed to root for the monster antagonist. This isn't like Frankenstein's monster.
No.
Where there's some sympathy on this. This is it's a wild animal doing what animals do and eating things.
Did you see that we've come full... This is off subject, but did you see that we've come full circle with Frankenstein? That there's a whole bunch of people out there that's trying to, really hard trying to explain to people that, that Frankenstein's monster was not a monster at all. It's a victim. And anyone like us that's actually read the book or seen any type of an adaptation of Frankenstein's monster is like, that is literally the point of the book. What do you think you're trying to argue here? You're not, you didn't just come to an epiphany. Like, I mean,
God, I hate it. I hate people. I hate it here. I don't want to live on this planet anymore.
But, so anywho, I decide to read the book, and I read the book and could not stand the characters. None of the characters. There are numerous changes. It's been a while since I've read the book, but I believe I told Chris while we were watching the film, I believe in the book, Quint is a Vietnam War veteran as opposed to a World War II veteran. And,
The monologue that he gives in the movie, the USS Indianapolis, it's not even in the book.
No, because they don't even talk about the Indianapolis in the book. There's an entire subplot of an affair between the character of Hooper and Brody's wife, Ellen. The shark dies in literally, I'm going to save this part until the end of the episode, whenever you get to, because there's a production thing about the death of the shark and all that. Whenever you get to that point, then I'll share, like, this is how the shark died in the book. And be like, can you see why Spielberg wanted to change this? So I'm just going to keep that under wraps for right now. But yeah, massively different. And it's one of the things, you know, how a lot of people will say, well, the book is always better than the movie. 99.9% of the time, I agree with that. This is one of the very rare occurrences in which the movie is superior to the book in literally every single way. When I say every single way, there is nothing about the book to where I'm like, man, I wish they would have put that in there, or I wish they would have done this, or why did they change that? There's nothing. There is literally nothing that the movie did worse than the book. Like, you know, the movie did a good job whenever there are people out there that have no idea Jaws is based on a book. Like, because nobody talks about the book.
Yeah.
Like, that's just how much the movie overshadows the book at this point. But anywho, so I read the book, couldn't stand the book, and so now we're going to talk about how Jaws ended up coming to be. And naturally, Chris, if you feel like throwing in some commentary absolutely here and there and all that kind of stuff, you know, I don't want to just sit here and have you sitting there twiddling your thumbs while I'm going over all of this stuff. But anywho.
I got some things I can add here and there.
Okay. So Peter Benchley is the man that ended up writing the book. Now, I will go on ahead and say that I am a fan of Peter Benchley. While he is primarily known for Jaws, he's written some other very good books. He wrote White Shark. Mm-hmm. I'm a very big fan of. The name White Shark was actually, there is an adaptation to that. It's called Creature. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Can't say that I have, it's but like, it's possible that I might have.
If you probably know it, but you just don't know that that's what it is. It delves a lot more into like the science fiction kind of thing. It's like a biologically engineered shark that at one point evolves to where, like, it becomes kind of like a were-shark kind of thing. It was really cool in the 90s whenever I watched it on TV. I have not seen it since, so I don't know. But I do own the book, White Shark. He also wrote The Beast, which deals with a giant squid that goes on a rampage and everything.
The made-for-TV movie of that is fantastic.
It is, and I also own the book to that and have read it. Both of those books are very good. There's another book that he wrote. I believe he wrote this book after Jaws, and it was called The Deep. It also stars Robert Shaw, and it ended up being turned into a movie. I have not read the book to The Deep, but I did watch the movie to The Deep. But it's been a number of years ago, and I remember liking it from what I saw. But I really can't tell you a whole lot about it. Obviously, because Robert Shaw is in the film, he steals the show. But anywho, so Peter Benchley, he was trying to be a writer. He was trying to make it as an author. He had been doing a bunch of freelance jobs and everything at this point in time, early 70s, 1971, 72, something like that. Well, he's pretty much fallen on hard times. He's having a hard time supporting his family. And so he's like, I don't know how much longer I can do this. And so he decided to pretty much go for one last ditch effort and say, this is going to be it for me as an author. Either I make it with this, or I'm done being an author, writer, freelance writer, anything, whatever, and I'm moving on to do something else. So he had his agent set up a number of meetings and everything. And the meetings that was set up, he had two main ideas that he was trying to pitch. One of them dealt with pirates. The other one dealt with a man-eating shark that terrorizes a community. So
the concept of him basing this off of the Jersey Shore shark attacks, that's not as cut and dry as some people want to try and claim it is.
There's a lot of people that, for those of you that don't know, there were legit the first ever actual recorded shark attacks.
Which would have been a bull shark as well, by the way.
Back in the day. Took place in 1916. They're called the Jersey Shore attacks. There's been a number of non-fiction books made for TV, movies. I've seen the vast majority of them. I have a non-fiction book. I think it's called Close to Shore, and that's a very good one.
I've read that one.
There's another book called 12 Days of Terror, and it shares a name with a made-for-TV movie, 12 Days of Terror. I've seen numerous documentaries on it and all of that. This is pretty much what this event is, where the Great White Shark got its, pretty much, his reputation as a man-eater.
Yeah, but it wasn't even a great white shark. It was believed to be a bull shark.
It could have been both or whatever, because one of the attacks took place, the shark swam up a river and attacked a boy, and then while they were trying to retrieve the body of that boy, it attacked another man, but it happened in fresh water. Mm-hmm. Great white sharks cannot survive in fresh water.
Bull sharks come up the Mississippi all the time.
But whenever they actually started hunting for the sharks, they captured a great white. The shark attacks ceased, so who knows if the bull shark just moved on or, you know, whatever. Or if the bull shark was just passing through that one particular day, went up the river, got him a meal, and then took off or whatever. Who knows? They captured a great white shark. That's where the great white shark got its reputation as, like, the biggest, meanest, most terrible man-eater in the world, even though they've been proven numerous times to be very docile creatures.
Yeah, they're basically giant ponies.
To be very, very curious creatures. Bull sharks, hammerheads, makos, far more aggressive than great whites are. I believe makos are. Don't quote me on that, people.
It's
all right?
Not so much that makos are aggressive. It's that because they're quicker moving and they have a faster metabolism, the whole idea of a blood frenzy applies far more to them than others, especially because they typically hunt in packs. There's more than one Mako shark around when you see that kind of an environment.
And I must emphasize that it is pronounced as Mako, unlike not the one Mako character in Jaws whenever they go to capture the tiger shark and they're trying to figure out what it is. And one character just randomly goes, "I think it's a Mako." Yeah. I'm a, what the heck is a Mako? Especially because Hooper literally 30 seconds later mentions a Mako by name. So
tiger sharks can be aggressive, but
they're also man-eaters.
Yes, they are. But they're also not so much shoreline predators like you would see with a hammerhead or a bull shark. Bull sharks, they've studied like their brainwave patterns up, and they're just naturally just shorter-tempered animals. Like, they're very aggressive, very territorial. It doesn't take a lot to set them off, which is why there was a movie that came out, I want to say 2003, about a bull shark coming up the water called Red Water. It had Lou Diamond Phillips in it. I actually really like that movie.
I don't think I've seen that one.
It's actually pretty good.
But like bull sharks are known as the dumpsters of the sea, because they eat anything. There has been, no joke, a full suit of armor found inside the stomach of a bull shark. Like, I mean, they will literally eat anything.
Basically angry billy goats with sharp teeth.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's the actual event that really started the whole craze about sharks attacking people whenever they go swimming in the ocean and all that kind of stuff. And it's always been speculated that Benchley had used this as inspiration. Whether he did or not, he's never mentioned it. To my knowledge,
From what I understand, it's not mentioned in the book at all. It's mentioned in a passing reference
very passing, yes.
When they're like, this has happened before. Tell them, the shark attacks, Jersey Shore. Like the,
the shark attacks in 1916,
Jersey Shore and everything. And then they move right past it.
Yeah, and that's it. It's not mentioned in the book at all, to my knowledge. Of course, it's been a while since I've read that trash.
And you'll see things like, I survived the Jersey Shore shark attacks. And if you flip that little book on the back, it says, from the real life event that inspired the major motion picture and book Jaws. And it's like, it really didn't, though. The only way we would know that it inspired it would have been Peter Benchley himself saying it. And man's been dead for a while, so I don't think we're going to be able to ask him.
Yeah, so you guys know I'm a big, I look up into a lot of like man eaters, like man eating events, like the man eaters of Tsavo, which we've covered on his podcast.
In my archives, we did an episode on the Ghost of the Darkness where we talked about that.
Yeah, so that's a very good creature feature. And then, you know, there's numerous crocodile man eaters, like real ones, not just on movies and stuff like that, like Gustav and Lolong and all of that kind of mess. So if you feel like looking into the Jersey Shore attacks, go ahead and do it. Like I said, there's literally a slew of documentaries and made-for-TV movies and all of that kind of stuff that I suggest watching a documentary on it first.
Yeah, before because you don't want to pop in two-headed Jersey Shore shark attack, because I'm sure that exists.
Oh, yeah. So just watch a documentary. It's pretty good. But anywho,
Sharktopus.
The main... Don't get me started
We'll talk about those in those
sci-fi original... Yeah. But anywho, so Benchley's thing was he wanted to do a story either about pirates or a man-eating great white shark that terrorizes a community. The actual inspiration for Jaws that he openly admits was one of the main things that inspired him to write Jaws was there was a man that caught and killed a 4,550-pound great white off of Long Island in 1964.
That's
and
a big shark.
It was just one of those deals where he was just kind of like, man, I wonder if how we would be if, like, one of those things was just off the coast and, like, terrorizing a community and all that. And so the story had always just really stuck with him and all of that. And so whenever his agent set up a meeting with some publishers, publishing company known as Doubleday, the person that was representing that publishing company is Thomas Congdon. And so he meets with Benchley and was basically like, okay, Benchley, what do you got? Benchley pitched the pirate story. He pitched a few nonfiction things that he wanted to do, but he mainly, like, he just mentioned the shark attack story. And so Congdon was like, well, hold on. Let's talk about that. Like, what do you mean, like, a man-eating shark story? Benchley elaborates on it a little bit and everything. They were immediately interested. Okay, we're going to do this. This is what we want to do and all of that. So, they gave him an advance of $1,000. That's a pretty good sum of money back then in the 70s. Okay, so they give him an advance of $1,000 and said, we want you to come up with the first 100 pages to the novel, which would end up becoming the first four chapters of the novel. And it's like, if we like what we see, we'll give you another advance and you can go ahead and start trying to give us this story and everything. So he submitted the 100 pages. They ended up liking it to an extent. One thing they really didn't care for about it was the tone. Like, the tone just didn't fit. And I'll talk about that later on. But they liked the general idea, so then they paid him $7,500 and said, give us a full manuscript of the book. Now, the reason you could get away with this in the 70s, not today. The reason why they were so confident in Benchley and was giving him advances before he had even given them the book or anything like that is because just listening to him talk about sharks, they thought he was an expert on sharks. They were like, so you pretty much know,
bamboozled.
Like, they know what you're talking about, basically. And he's like, oh, and, but he would openly say, I know more than the average, like, shark person, because he did read a pretty good amount of books. He had watched a few documentaries and all that kind of stuff. But these guys thought he was a little bit higher up the chain than what he actually was with sharks and everything like that. So that's why they gave him this advance, because it's like, well, he's going to be writing a book about a man-eating shark. He's essentially a shark expert. This is going to work out very well. Well, after that happened, he started reading a lot more nonfiction, watching a lot more documentaries so that he could get all the information that he possibly could and everything. There was just one problem. Not only, since he was given all of this money in advance, $7,500 for the manuscript, $1,000 for the 100 pages. We're looking at $8,500. That is a massive sum of money.
That's a substantial amount of money for the 70s.
Do the conversion. Do the conversion.
Little miniature conversion. Hey, help us with this.
Yeah, I pointed at Chris's phone. It was like, do the conversion. Do the inflation. Let's see what it is. It's a substantial amount of money. Just to let you guys know that in the movie, I looked it up while we were watching the movie, whatever, they offer... $52,000. $52,000. Well, I should have known that from what the statement that I was just fixing to say. So, $52,000, because I looked that up when we were watching the movie, and whenever Quint says he's not going to risk his neck for $3,000, he's like, I'll find him for $3,000, but I'll catch him and kill him for $10,000. So I looked up to see how much $10,000 was, and I believe I told you $54,000 or $56,000. I think it was $56,000.
Right in that area.
And so, yeah, I should have known that $8,500 wasn't going to be a whole lot less than that. But anywho, so yeah, this guy was given an advance of $52,000 for this one book. Y'all, I have a very well-paying job. I do not make $52,000 in a year. I just don't. And he was given this as an advance. Here you go. Give us the book.
Man could have ran to Mexico and there'd have been nothing they could have done about it.
So, anywho, he starts, you know, he's doing his research and everything, but let's be honest here. He's also living the high life. Because, like I said, before this, he was on hard times. He's getting caught up on bills, but then he's also just doing things. I'm not saying he was just going out and blowing his money, but he is just, you know, taking his time and everything. He's like, for once in a very long time, he does not have to worry about money at all. Well, it was taking him a while to actually get the manuscript out and everything, and so his agent actually came to him and was like, hey, you really need to, you know, turn in this manuscript for these people. And Benchley was kind of like, oh, you know, it'll be all right. You know, I'll get to it eventually. And they seem interested. I can take my time and everything. And the agent pretty much said they had a stipulation that if you did not complete the novel at this certain time, you have to return their money.
Oh, no.
He's already spent their money.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden, Peter Benchley says, oh, shenanigans.
Oh, right.
And so he kicks it into overdrive trying to write this book and all that, okay? And so much so that to get some peace and quiet so that he could absolutely focus on the book. Now, I've seen two different sources refer to it once as chickens and once as turkeys. But nonetheless, for him to be able to get, like, just total peace and quiet and be able to focus on writing this book, he converted either a chicken coop or a turkey coop on his wife's family's land as like his little office so that he could write the book and all that kind of stuff. So that's what he ended up doing. It works, man. Hey, you got to do what you got to do whenever you're on the verge of having to give up $52,000. Yeah, you're going to do what you got to do. But so he very quickly sent the first draft in and was like, okay, guys, here's the first draft of the manuscript. What do you guys think about this? The publishers read it. They looked at it and they read it. And they did not care for the tone. He wrote the initial attack on the character of Chrissy. And it was very grueling. It was very, you know, it was pretty good and all that. Or the reaction to the attack. I can't remember exactly. It's been a long time since I read the book. But he wrote the beginning. And the tone is one way. But then later, the rest of the book is very kind of comedic and lighthearted and all of that kind of stuff. So of his entire manuscript that he turned in, the publishers only accepted the first 5 pages.
And yikes. Said,
take every bit of this back and make it match the tone of these first 5 pages, and that's what we want. And so... that's pretty much what he had to do. Follow that same tone. And one of the things, this is where, you know, I've already mentioned it, Chris, I don't know if you're aware of this or not. This was during the time, it was during this time, this initial rewrite, that the affair between Hooper and Ellen would begin due to the publisher's suggestion. Because Benchley had put in a, love scene between Hooper and Ellen in the book. And the publishers saw that and basically was like, with the type of book that you're writing, there is no place in this book for a wholesome marital experience like that. However, with the type of book that you are writing, there's plenty of room for an affair. And so by their suggestion, he put in the affair.
No.
For Hooper and Ellen.
Good God.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. So yeah. So he goes back, he rewrites
it. Never so slightly.
He goes back, he rewrites it. It turns out to be pretty good and all that kind of stuff. So they're like, okay, this is good. We're going to go with this. They send it to the editors. They start, you know, working on like punctuation and all of that kind of stuff. Now it's on to an entirely different kind of problem with the book. What are they going to call it? And so, all in all, I'm only going to mention like the most popular ones that I was able to find on like IMDb and Wikipedia and stuff like that. But all in all, Benchley openly stated that they probably went through about 250 titles for this book. Okay, so some of the more popular ones that were potentially the titles of this book, which would end up being the film, are The Jaws of Death, Jaws of Leviathan, The Stillness in the Water.
I've heard that one.
Leviathan Rising. Now, for those of you that don't know anything about Leviathan, the reason why they're going with Leviathan is a very common name to be used for something terrible that's in the water. Quote, unquote, a sea monster. Because yeah. Leviathan is from the Bible. It does a very detailed description of Leviathan in the Bible, talking about how he had scales that was impenetrable to spears and swords and things like that, that he was able to breathe. It didn't necessarily say flames could come out of his mouth, but it did say that he breathed embers. That's basically saying that
fire breathing
or something like that, you know? And so, yeah, like, and there's more, like, it talked about how big he was and all of that kind of stuff. And so the word, and that's his name in the Bible, Leviathan. And Leviathan has pretty much become a name that many people use to describe something very, very massive, or some type of sea monster or sea creature or something like that.
You ever played the game Subnautica?
I have not played it, but I've seen lots of footage of it.
Basically, if you're afraid of deep water, don't ever play or watch this thing. It'll make you very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But like, it's the essential, and not to get off on a tangent, I promise this is related to it. The whole topic of the game is that you are on an exploration of a foreign planet that is mostly water. Your ship breaks down, so while you're there, you're trying to rig up certain things. You can go out in the water and look for it. You have radar that picks up, that detects if there are animals in there. One of the classes of animals that it can pick up is Leviathan class animals, and these are very large, dangerous aquatic animals.
Yes. Whenever I talked about like whaling and stuff like that, Moby Dick, the white whale of the Pacific, I believe I mentioned in that episode that during the entire whaling period for the whaling industry, the whales, the sperm whales, primarily, were referred to as Leviathan. Yeah. Moby Dick himself is referred to as Leviathan numerous times in the novel Moby Dick. But anywho, so those are some of the titles that were almost chosen for this book. And so finally, 20 minutes before production of this book was set to begin, Benchley and someone else, one of the publishers or something like that, was sitting there thinking, what are we going to call this? They wanted something simple. All these other titles that I mentioned to you guys, they kind of saw them as pretentious. And they're like, we want something simple, something that can just fit in like one line across the top of the jacket. So they're like, okay, it's a word. We need one word. Throughout the vast majority of the titles that were being thrown out there, Jaws was being thrown out there. And so after a while, one of them said, I can't remember which one it is, one of them basically said, Jaws is the only thing that matters. So that's what we need to call it, Jaws. And so they said, okay. That was 20 minutes before production of the book. Ooh. So they called it Jaws. They said it can fit on the dust jacket. It's good to go. Boom. There we are.
Look, I've covered movies where the musical score was finished within days of it being done. or the effects were done within days of it being, like, Terminator 2 specifically was like 3 days, the day of its theatrical release.
That's when the film was delivered.
3 hours before it was to debut was when the final reels were delivered.
Yeah.
You talking cutting it close.
Cutting it close. But so, anywho, so now they have a title. Now they got to come up with the cover. Originally, the cover was just simply going to be a black background with Jaws on it. One of the publishers said, "We don't like that." They said, "Why don't you like that?" He said, "It's just a black cover with the word Jaws on it. You could be talking about dentistry for all we know."
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah,
fair point.
Yeah, well,
that's a fair point.
You got a point there. So, so they said, okay, we're not going to do that. So then they said, we need to add a swimmer onto the cover. A swimmer and a shark. All right. At first, it was going to be just a shark. I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself with my notes. At first, it was going to be just a shark. But then they said, we want people to know immediately that this is a novel about horror and danger. So just putting the shark on there, it might make people think it's a nonfiction book or something like that. It's like, add a swimmer to it so that people will see the shark going after the swimmer. They'll immediately pretty much get the idea of like, okay, there's some kind of horror element / theme to this and all of that. So they ended up getting an individual by the name of Paul Bacon to do the cover. And whenever I tell you that the original cover for the hardcover very first release, which I own, of Jaws is about as simple as it gets. The swimmer, it looks very similar to the theatrical poster.
Yeah.
Not near as detailed. If I could describe it to you in any kind of way, basically, put your hand out and do a thumbs up motion. Look at the back of your thumb. Kind of enlarge it a little bit. And now make it be the color of a shark and give it teeth. That's what the shark looks like.
Oh, y'all couldn't see that, but I just did that as he was walking through, and he could see my face going, huh, lobby.
Because I just showed him the book earlier. I was like, I don't know if I ever told you I have this, and I brought out the book, and he's like, no, you never told me that you have this. So he just saw the original cover for the book. And
because
I've
seen other re-releases of the book. They basically just have the poster from the movie on it.
Yeah.
Or slightly touched differently.
The hardcover first release in 1974 are the only books that have that original cover on it. And so the swimmer is up at the top, very similar to the theatrical release poster and all of that kind of stuff. So it's like, okay, this is our poster. This is what we're going with and all of that kind of stuff. Here you go. So the book is being published and everything. Books are generally published in hardcover first and paperbacks come later and all that. There was just one little problem. They didn't like the artwork. They thought it was too simple. They thought it was a little too cartoony. They really wanted to show, like, we need something terrifying for this. So they hired an individual by the name of Roger Castell and said, we want you to come up with... He's a painter. He wasn't just a simple artist. He was like a legit painter, and we're like, we want you to come up with this terrifying looking poster to be for the paperback of the book. And so he said, okay. And so he went to various aquariums and was looking at sharks and watching sharks and all of that and taking photos of them so that he could have reference points and all of that kind of stuff. And then he, which I have a fun fact about that in just a second, but, and then, like, he went to this photography place where they were taking pictures of a model, and he asked her, after they were done taking pictures of her, he's like, if you don't mind, would you take a photo? I believe this is how the story went. He said, would you take a photo, but I want you laying across a stool, but be in like the position as if you're swimming. He said, I'm going to use this for some artwork. She said, okay. Got into it. Picture got snapped. He goes on and he starts, he pretty much starts coming up with the artwork, and the artwork that he came up with ended up being the very iconic and infamous image of Jaws that we all know and love to this day, of the shark coming up from underneath You have the swimmer who is swimming nude. She is supposed to be, you know, Chrissy from the beginning of the film. The water, like, of her swimming is covering up, like, a lot of her, you know, the good bits, pretty much, and everything. And so that's pretty much the artwork that came out. It was going to be on the paperback. They ended up loving the artwork so much, they said, we're going to use this for the theatrical poster as well. Because believe it or not, all of this is taking place in 1974. The film rights for the book had already been purchased in 1973.
Yeah, this movie's being filmed while they're doing that.
And so, yeah, like, that's happening. Well, now, here's the fun fact that I was going to tell you guys. And I'm just looking at my lenticular cover right now, just for the heck of it, that I have for Jaws. You know, like I said, this individual took a lot of pictures of sharks to go back and use for, to come up with inspiration for the painting and all of that kind of stuff. There's just one little itty-bitty problem that a lot of people have never really wanted to point out and everything. The particular shark that he chose is not a great white. I'm not sure what species is, to be honest with you. I used to know.
It looks like an oceanic white tip.
But the picture of Jaws that everyone knows and loves so well, that's not a great white.
That looks like an oceanic white
tip. The nose is far too pointed. And, you know, and amongst just other things and all that, the teeth, they're not triangular enough. They're too much dagger-shaped and all of that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it's just one of those deals to where it's like, you know, you go so many years, the main antagonist of the film is a great white shark, and you heard it here first, folks. That's not a great white shark on the poster. Nope. But, so, yeah, anywho, that's how that ended up coming about. Now, like I said, the film rights to the book was already bought and paid for in 1973, and so while all of this was happening, they're trying to put casting and all of that kind of stuff together and all of that. And what ended up... not casting yet. So what happens, how this they end up discovering it for a movie, is there were two producers. And they each individually discovered the book. And they kind of met up and was like, hey, I just found out about this book. And we're gonna check it out. We're going to read it. And so they read it. They read everything. It had not yet been published, okay? And so they read it. And they really, really enjoyed it. They're like, this could make a great movie. And so they start shopping around for directors. Two of the directors that were chosen first was one was John Sturges. The other was Dick Richards. Or, you know, the nickname for Richard is Dick. So I'm just going to call him Dick Dick. But,
my grandpa's name was Richard. He went by Dick.
But, John Sturges, they ended up passing on him. Dick Richards ended up getting passed on because at first he accepted and he was going to be the director of the film. They ended up letting him go because they got mad because anytime they would be talking about the movie and all of that kind of stuff, he kept incorrectly referring to the shark as a whale. And so they got mad at that and was like, you know what? No, we don't want you. You don't even know what creature the movie is about. Get out of here. So they got rid of him. Enter one Steven Spielberg. He had just got done doing the film The Sugarland Express. Okay? He's having a meeting with these producers and he notices the book, the unpublished book at the time. He notices it and is basically like, hey, what's that? And so they start talking to him about it and all of that kind of stuff. And he was like, that sounds interesting. They're like, do you want it? And he's like, yeah, I want it. So he became the director of Jaws and all that kind of stuff. Now, as far as the casting, I'm not going to jump real big into all the casting and all that kind of stuff. I'm just going to talk mainly about some of the main bigger name people and iconic characters and all that. Spielberg specifically wanted to avoid big names, because he wanted people to view the shark as the star of the show, and said that if he got too big of names, the movie would immediately become a movie for them.
Yeah, like it'd be their vehicle.
For example, Charlton Heston is one of the individuals that was almost picked to play Brody, And the reason he was passed up on is because Spielberg said it would end up becoming a Charlton Heston
exactly.
film. I do not want it to be a Charlton Heston film. I want it to be a shark movie.
Plus, with it being Charlton Heston, the only movie that he had kind of died in hadn't even come out yet, and that was The Omega Man.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'll get to that in just a minute. He wanted to avoid big names. The shark is the star. The very first person that was cast was Lorraine Gary, who would end up being cast as Ellen Brody, the wife of Chief Brody. She was also the wife of the president of Universal. So, can you say that's how she got the job? I'm not going to lie, she does a good job in this film. She really does.
In this film.
In Jaws the Revenge, she's trash.
She's good in Jaws too. What little we get of her.
Just a little bit. But in Jaws, dude, the Revenge, trash. Garbage. I love that movie. It's trash. All right, but anywho.
Roaring shark and all. But we will cover that. Don't worry.
We're going to talk about it.
We'll talk about that on my show. Don't worry about that. So
Murray Hamilton was cast as the mayor, one of my all-time favorite movie villains.
He only died last year.
Yeah, that's sad. But yeah, one of my all-time favorite movie villains. Susan Becklinney? I don't know how you pronounce that. She was cast as Chrissy. Chrissy, everyone knows, one of the most iconic characters in the history of film because of her death that happens at the beginning of the movie. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, I bet she had a pretty interesting way as to how she got cast or, you know, something like that. You know, did she know the director? Did she know this? Did she know that? Did she know this person? Or, you know, did she just nail the audition and everything? No. How she got cast in the role of Chrissy was for two reasons. One, she was a good swimmer. Two, she was willing to get naked on camera. That's it. Those are the reasons why she was cast.
Hey, man.
And she was qualified for that position.
That's something we noticed today because we watched this in 4K, right?
I've never seen this in a 4K version.
It's been
a
few years since both of us have seen this movie. Watching it in 4K, it's much more descriptive, much more cleaned up.
Like the lighting is better and all that. And so, yeah, let me tell you that at the beginning, when she's running to the beach and she starts stripping off her clothes, me and Chris are like, that's an awful lot more detailed than what we're used to seeing.
Oh, quite.
Gets in the water. Underwater scenes, you can virtually see
the whole
everything.
Shebang.
And I was just like, yep, 4K is a game changer.
This is 1970s PG as well.
Yeah, and so, yeah, like the quality back then was not the best. So that's why she was chosen, because it's like, you're a good swimmer and you're willing to get naked. So that's what we're going to go with. And so, boom, she got it. Now, on to Brody, who was played by the very underrated actor Roy Scheider. The guy is a champion. The guy is a beast. Like, I'm a big fan of his work. And unfortunately, just because of the size of this film, a lot of his other stuff is very much overshadowed. But he's a very good actor. He has a lot of other very good performances and stuff like that.
He was also a boxer for a brief period. He was a pretty good boxer.
He ended up getting the role. He was not the first choice. The first choice was actually Robert Duvall. Robert Duvall turned it down. The next choice... It wasn't necessarily a choice, but this individual showed interest in it, and that was Charlton Heston. He showed interest, wanted to do it. Spielberg nearly immediately shot it down under the premise of what I said just a little while ago. He did not want this to turn into
a Charlton Heston
film. And also, it was one of those deals to where it's like, everyone knows Charlton Heston is going to beat this shark.
Yeah, he's not going to die.
There's not going to be a sense of danger or anything like that. So he said... No. And unfortunately, Charlton Heston held a grudge against Steven Spielberg for that for many, many years. I honestly don't know if they ever worked out the differences there. He always held a grudge.
Heston seems like he could hold a grudge.
As much as I love Charlton Heston, he's in my top 10 favorite actors of all time. He was a product of his time, and he had a way about him. And so, anywho, how Roy Scheider ended up finding out about Jaws was he overheard a conversation between Steven Spielberg and some other individuals about, and so then the shark jumps on the boat and he comes over and is like, what? That's a reference to the movie. We'll talk about that later on. And so he expressed his interest to it and all of that. And then he ended up getting cast in the role. Spielberg was actually very hesitant to put Scheider in the role because he was afraid he was going to portray too much of a tough guy because of, one, just who he is, he is, and two, a role that he had played just prior to what he would be doing with Jaws, he played a tough guy. Like, Brody is supposed to be kind of a pushover. He's supposed to be a very wimpy, like, not know how to do much kind of guy. And he's like, I don't know if Roy's going to be able to pull that off. But he ended up getting the role. And boy, howdy, did he nail it.
I'd argue the only point where you don't really see that is when he finally grabs the mayor by the arm and is like, you're going to sign this. And then later when Quint destroys the radio and he's got the baseball bat and he's calling him certified. I'm like, dude, you're looking pretty psycho yourself there.
Yeah. So
Scheider's not a small man either. No. He was about 6'2", 6'3".
Anywho, 9 days before production was set to begin, they still had not cast Quint or Hooper. Now, how Quint ended up getting cast, first choice was another one of my all-time favorite actors by the name of Lee Marvin. He decided to pass on the role.
Oh, Lee Marvin, such a tough dude for the old Westerns and all kinds of things. That man exuded toughness for a long time.
And he was in the Marines as well, during the war, I believe. So, Lee Marvin was... He didn't just pretend to be what he was.
You have to be that tough to unironically enjoy being in a movie called Paint Your Wagon.
Yeah, like, God, I love Lee Marvin. But anywho, Sterling Hayden was another individual that was in the runnings. He also said no. Believe it or not, George Lucas. Is that the right one? Am I looking at the right one? Nope, wrong one. Don't worry about that.
Give it a second on that one.
Yeah, give it a second on that one. Shaw ended up getting pitched to Spielberg by somebody. I can't remember who. But it was basically like, hey, you might want to look at this guy. You might like him and all that. Initially, Shaw decided, he's like, okay, I'm kind of interested. He read the book. He hated the book. He didn't want the part. He's like, no, I'm good. I have no desire to do this. The only thing that changed his mind was it was his mom... And his wife, I believe, sure. That, like, was like, they read the book and found out things about it and all that kind of stuff. And they're like, no. You need to say yes to this. And he's like, I hate the book. I hate the characters. I don't want nothing to do with it. And they're like, you need to say yes to this. And he said the only other time they had ever been that excited about him being cast in a movie. I can't remember the name of the movie. But it was another big name movie that he was in. And he said he thought it was going to be bad. It turned out to be good. He's like, they were right about that. They're probably going to be right about this one. Boy, were they. So, so we got Shaw as Quint. Now, of those guys that I mentioned, you sit there and think, who could have done the role better than Robert Shaw or Roy Scheider or something like that? Personally, I can't picture anyone else.
Absolutely.
For Roy. I just can't. For Hooper, a little bit here and there.
Well, there's one specifically that I think could have been just fine.
For Quint, I legitimately can see Lee Marvin in the role.
I can see that too.
I think he would have been pretty good, but he just flat out said no.
So. And I think that actually, as good as I think Lee Marvin could have been for that, and this is something we'll cover a little bit more on my part of the my contribution, but Robert Shaw was very instrumental to a major success with this film.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll get to that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we're going to talk about it. You best believe. And so, anywho, he accepts. Boom, we got it. So now we're just waiting on Hooper. Hooper ended up getting played by Richard Dreyfuss. Richard Dreyfuss is a national treasure. We all love Richard Dreyfuss.
Yep.
Now, anywho, there was a pretty good amount of guys that were looked at to play the role of Hooper. Some of them were John Voight, Jeff Bridges, Timothy Bottoms, Kevin Klein, Joel Grey.
I can't for the life of me see John Voight in that.
As much as I love him and things
like The Deer Hunter and Deliverance and whatnot, I can't see him.
John Voight just, no,
Of the names you mentioned, the only one I think that could have slotted into that role and been just fine and you wouldn't really have missed out on much would have been Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges probably could have done well. But anywho, amongst others, those were just the biggest names that I felt like mentioning and everything. Now, let's try this again. Believe it or not, George Lucas, very good friend of Steven Spielberg, is actually the one that dropped Richard Dreyfuss's name and said, you need to give this kid a shot. He's pretty good. I think he would end up being pretty good for the role and everything. So Spielberg reaches out to him and was like, hey, you know, you got a lot of good talk from my buddy George Lucas and this and that. This is before Star Wars, y'all. So, you know, like just throwing that out there. But he's like, you know, my buddy George talks real big, real good about you and all that. So figured, thought I'd offer you the role of Hooper. What do you think? And Richard Dreyfuss promptly rejected him. Mm-hmm. And said, nope, I have no desire to be in that. Thank you very much. Hope everything works out well for you. I'm gone. And that was it. He walked away from Jaws, was not going to do it. The only reason he got cast as Hooper for Jaws was because he went to a pre-release screening of his latest film, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. Okay? While watching his screening and his performance, he was like, this is terrible.
He was panicking.
And he's like, I don't think people's going to want to work with me. I don't think this, I don't think that, but
that's
this
gonna
is
the end of my career.
He's like, but this is a pre-screen release, so nobody knows about this yet. What does he do? Call up Steven Spielberg and be like, hey, you still need that guy for Hooper? I'm your man. I had a change of heart. I decided don't ever watch The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz, by the way, but I've decided that I'm going to be your Hooper. And so Spielberg said, okay, and he was hired. And so, yeah, that's what happened. And then after he got to set, he was essentially like, oh, so I hear this movie's based on a book. Like, I'll read the book so that we can, you know, pretty much, I'll know what all's going on. Since Spielberg had already changed the character of Hooper so much from the book, like, while writing the script and everything, had already changed the character of Hooper so much, he flat out told Richard Dreyfuss, do not read the book. Said, you will end up not liking your character. I don't want you to read it. Just avoid reading it. And so he did. He avoided reading it. And because of the charisma of Richard Dreyfuss and his personality and all of that kind of stuff, they ended up rewriting the character even more to suit
Richard Dreyfuss
a little bit
very
more.
Similar to how they changed up how George Costanza was to more better resemble the things that Jason Alexander wanted to do.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing. And so that's what happened and everything. And so, boom, just like that, the book is very soon to be hitting shelves. The movie is well underway. They have the cast that's all said and ready to go. And so production would soon begin. And let me tell you, Chris is going to be handling the production on his show. So this is pretty much the end of my show. But boy, howdy, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, you guys are in for a doozy of a time hearing about the production of Jaws. Because when I tell you, if it could go wrong, it went wrong. That's what it was like on set for this movie.
Okay. So for part two, you need to tune into my show, Kid Kong at the Movies. For those of y'all that have tuned into my show before, you know exactly where it is. For those of you that have not, it is on Spotify, Google, Apple, all that. And it's Kid Kong, K-I-D-D, Kong at the Movies. So,
It's on all the same platforms that pretty much mine is, Spotify, you know.
Kaiju Carnage drops on Saturday.
July 1st, Saturday.
Kid Kong at the Movies will drop on July 2nd.
On Sunday.
Yeah.
So, that's how it's going to go. So, all right, guys, I hope you guys enjoyed listening to me ramble on and get
my
off subject.
Contributions. There will be more back and forth conversation on the next episode, simply because in addition to talking about the production and the reception, we're also going to discuss the impact this movie has had, its legacy, its genre defining this, its real world applications that have come from this movie's sheer existence and success.
Yeah, well, one legacy impact that that I can tell just right now off the top of my head, I've mentioned this on this show before, guys, is that in, well, you know, this movie inspired countless other directors and all of that kind of stuff and everything, but keep in mind, always keep in mind where you come from and everything. You know, I made the comment one time that everything gets traced back to the 1933 King Kong, in which the 1933 King Kong was inspiration for The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which led to the inspiration to 1954's Gojira, which led to the Americanized version that came out in 1956.
Which is the whole reason
Which Steven Spielberg watched that film and said, that's the movie that made him decide he wants to get into filmmaking. And now here we are talking about Jaws. So, again, as I said, it can always be traced back to the 1933 King Kong. It's arguable that that's the greatest film of all time. But that is for another time. So, alrighty, guys. Thank you all for tuning in and listening to us ramble about Jaws. I hope, sincerely hope, that you guys go over to Kid Kong's show and listen to part two to hear about the production and the legacy and impact and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, if not, then to heck with you. And if you do, thank you and all that kind of stuff. I will go ahead and say he is going to just barely go over some of the things.
Just to catch anybody up, because I'm not necessarily expecting someone to listen to this one and then mine back to back like that. You know, Kaiju Carnage drops on Saturday. I know a good portion of y'all listen the day it comes out or in the following days. So it might be a few days later before you even get to listen to the follow-up. So it's going to be bare bones, like basically like we touched on this on there, but this is a brief synopsis and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and all that stuff. And then the roles will simply be reversed. Chris will be doing the majority of the talking, and I will be the one throwing in little quips and stuff like that and little fun facts and all that kind of mess. I've got some things off the top of my head that I just pretty much already know. If you don't say anything about it, hold that thought. Absolutely. And then I'll jump in.
Absolutely. And I will go ahead and stress as well that while Cal's and my shows have a lot of similarities, there are some differences. So you might, it's going to be just a little different type of format on my show.
The big difference is to say that I'm a tad bit more laid back than you.
Yeah. I like to talk about the production and I like to get through everything that you can. But I'm also very willing to pause what we're doing to have the discussion around it, as you guys have noticed, causing this to stretch a little bit here and there. But anyway.
So, alrighty, guys. Thank y'all once again. This has been Kid Kong.
Yes, I am.
And this is Cal the Kaiju Guy signing out.